Hello and welcome back to this episode of Book Club Commune with me, your host, Ivy Poese. Today we're going to be reading Chapter 6 of Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capital by Vladimir Lenin. The chapter is The Division of the World Among the Great Powers. I don't have anything really to say except sorry for the long wait. I just got done with finals week recently, so what the fuck are you going to do? Without any further ado, let's get right into the text. Chapter 6, The Division of the World Among the Great Powers. In his book, The Territorial Development of the European Colonies, A. Supont, the geographer, briefly sums up this development at the end of the 19th century as follows. What follows is a graph which shows the percentage of territories belonging to the European colonial powers, including the United States, in Africa, Polynesia, Asia, Australia, and America. As time has gone on, from the control of the European powers plus America over the continent has increased dramatically, all the way up to from 10% of Africa in 1876 to 90% in 1900. The chauvinist characteristic features of this period, he concludes, is therefore the division of Africa and Polynesia, as Polynesia went up from 56 to 98.9, and nothing else went up nearly as much. As there are no unoccupied territories, that is, territories that do not belong to any state in Asia and America, Mr. Supont's conclusion must be carried further, and we must say that the characteristic feature of this period is the final partition of the globe. Not in the sense that a new partition is impossible. On the contrary, new partitions are possible and inevitable. But in the sense that the colonial policy of the capitalist countries has completed the seizure of unoccupied territories on our planet. For the first time, the world is completely shared out, so that in the future, only redivision is possible. Territories can only pass from one owner to another, instead of passing as unowned territory to an owner. Hence, we are passing through a peculiar period of world colonial policy, which is closely associated with the latest phase of capitalist development, with finance capital. For this reason, it is essential to deal in detail with the facets in order to ascertain exactly what distinguishes this period from those preceding it, and what the present situation is. In the first place, two questions of fact arise here. Is an intensification of colonial policy an intensification of the struggle for colonies observed in this period of finance capital? And how, in this respect, is the world divided at the present time? The American writer Morris, in his book The History of Colonization, has made an attempt to compile data on the colonial positions of Great Britain, France, Germany during different periods of the 19th century. The following is a brief summary of the results he has obtained. Great Britain increased its area in millions of square miles from unknown in 1815 to 9.3 in 1899. And likewise, the others increased their holdings from 1815 to 1899, although Germany is only marked in 1899. For Great Britain, the period of enormous expansion of colonial conquest is that between 1860 and 1880, and it was also very considerable in the last 20 years of the 19th century. For France and Germany, this period falls precisely in these last 20 years. We saw above the apex of pre-monopoly capitalist development of capitalism, in which free competition was predominant, was reached in the 60s and 70s of the last century. We now see that it's precisely following the period that the boom in colonial annexation begins, and that the struggle for a territorial division of the world becomes extraordinarily keen. It is beyond doubt, therefore, that the transition of capitalism to monopoly capitalism, to finance capitalism, is connected with the intensification of the struggle for the partition of the world. Hobson, in his work on imperialism, marks the years 1884-1900 as the period of intensification of the colonial expansion of the chief European states. According to his estimate, Great Britain during these years acquired 3.7 million square miles of territory with a population of 57 million inhabitants. France acquired 3.6 square million square miles with a population of 36.5 million inhabitants. Germany, 1 million square miles with a population of 16.7 million inhabitants. Belgium, 900 square miles with 30 million inhabitants. Portugal, 800 square miles with 9 million inhabitants. a quest for colonies by all the capitalist states at the end of the 19th century, and particularly since the 1880s, is a commonly known fact in the history of diplomacy and of foreign affairs. When free competition in Great Britain was at its height, i.e. between 1840 and 1860, the leading British bourgeoisie politicians were opposed to the colonial policy, and were of the opinion that the liberation of the colonies and their complete separation from Great Britain was inevitable and desirable. M. Beer, in an article, Modern British Imperialism, published in 1898, shows that in 1852, Disraeli, a statesman generally inclined towards imperialism, declared, "The colonies are millstones around our necks." At the end of the 19th century, the heroes of the hour were Cecil Rhodes and Joseph Chamberlain, open advocates of imperialism, who compiled the imperialist policy in the most cynical manner. It is not without interest to observe that even at the time, those leading British bourgeois politicians fully appreciated the connection between what might be called purely economic and the political social roots of modern imperialism. Chamberlain advocated imperialism by calling it a true, wise, and economic policy, and he pointed out particularly to the German, American, and Belgian competition which Great Britain was encountering in the world market. "Salvation lies in monopolies," said the capitalists as they formed cartels, syndicates, and trusts. "Salvation lies in monopolies," echoed the political leaders of the bourgeoisie, hastening to appropriate the parts of the world not yet shared out. The journalist Steed relates the following remarks uttered by his close friend Cecil Rhodes in 1895 regarding his imperialist ideas. Quote, "I was in the East End of London yesterday and attended a meeting of the unemployed. I listened to their wild speeches, which were just a cry for bread, bread, and bread, and on my way home, I pondered over the scene and became more and more convinced over the importance of imperialism. My cherished idea is the solution for the social problem, i.e., in order to save the 400 million inhabitants of the United Kingdom from a bloody civil war, we colonial statesmen must acquire new lands for settling the surplus population, to provide new markets for the goods produced in the factories and mines. The empire, as I've always said, is a bread and butter question. If you want to avoid civil war, you must become imperialists." End quote. This is what Cecil Rhodes, millionaire, king of finance, the man who was mainly responsible for the Boer War, said in 1895. Side note, he's also heavily a part of the De Beers diamond family in South Africa as well. His defense of imperialism is just crude and cynical, but in substance it does not differ from the theory advocated by Mears, Maslov, Sutkin, Postrov, David, and the founder of Russian Marxism, and others. Cecil Rhodes was somewhat more honest social chauvinist. To tabulate what as exactly as possible the territorial division of the world and the changes which have occurred during the last decade, we will take the data furnished by Suppan in the work already quoted on the colonial possessions of all the powers of the world. Suppan examines the years 1876 and 1900. We will take the year 1876, a year aptly selected, as it is precisely at the time that the pre-monopolist stage of development of West European capitalism can be said to have been completed. In the main, we will take the year 1914, and in place of Suppan's figures, we will quote the more recent statistics of Hübner, geographical and statistical tables. Suppan gives figures for colonies only. We think it useful, in order to present a complete picture of the division of the world, to add brief figures on non-colonial and semi-colonial countries like Persia, Turkey, China, and China. Persia is already almost completely a colony. China and Turkey are on the way to becoming colonies. We thus get the following summary. I'm just gonna skip that. We see from these figures how complete was the partition of the world at the beginning, at the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th centuries. After 1876, colonial possessions increased to an enormous degree, more than 1.5 times, from 400 million to 65 million square kilometers in the area for the six biggest powers, an increase of 25 million square kilometers. That is 1.5 times greater than the area of the home countries, which have a total of 16.5 square kilometers. In 1876, three powers had no colonies, and a fourth, France, had scarcely any. In 1914, these four powers had 14.1 million square kilometers of colonies, or an area 1.5 times greater than that of Europe, with a population of nearly 100 million. The unevenness of the rate of expansion of colonial possessions is very marked. If, for instance, we compare Germany, France, and Japan, which do not differ very much in area and population, we will see that in the first, France has annexed almost 3 times as much colonial territory as the other two combined. But in regards to finance capital, also, France, at the beginning of the period we are considering, was perhaps several times richer than Germany and Japan put together. In addition to, and on the basis of purely economic causes, geographical conditions and other factors also affected the dimensions of colonial possessions. However strong the process of leveling the world, of leveling economic and living conditions in different countries may have been in the past decades as a result of the pressure of large-scale industry exchange and finance capital, great differences still remain, even among the six powers. We see first young capitalist powers, America, Germany, Japan, which progressed very rapidly. Secondly, countries with an old capitalist development, France and Great Britain, which have made much slower progress than the previously mentioned countries. And thirdly, a country, Russia, which is economically most backward and in which modern capitalist imperialism is enmeshed, so to speak, in a thick web of pre-capitalist relations. Alongside the colonial possessions of these great powers, we have placed the small colonies of the small states, which are, so to speak, the next possible and probable objects of the new colonial share-out. Most of these little states are able to retain their colonies only because of the conflicting interests, frictions, etc. among the big powers, which prevent them from coming to an agreement in regards to the division of the spoils. The semi-colonial states provide an example of the transitional forms which are to be found in all spheres of nature and society. Finance capital is such a great, it may be said, with such a decisive force in all economic and international relations that is capable of subordinating to itself, and actually does subordinate it to itself, even states enjoying complete political independence. We shall see shortly what sees examples of this. Naturally, finance capital finds itself as convenient and is able to extract the greatest profits from the subordination, which involves the loss of the political independence of the subjected countries and peoples. In this connection, the semi-colonial countries provide a typical example of the middle stage. It is natural that the struggle for these semi-dependent countries should have become particularly bitter during the period of finance capital, when the rest of the world. Colonial policy and imperialism existed before this latest stage of capitalism, even before capitalism. Rome, founded on slavery, pursued a colonial policy and achieved imperialism. But general arguments about imperialism, which ignore or put into the background the fundamental difference of social economic systems, inevitably degenerate into absolute empty banalities or into grandiloquent comparisons like Greater Rome or Greater Britain. Even the colonial policy of capitalism in its previous stages is essentially different from the colonial policy of finance capital. The principal feature of modern capitalism is the domination of monopolist combines of all big capitalists. These monopolies are most durable when all the sources of raw materials are controlled by one group. And we have seen what zeal the international capitalist combines exert every effort to make it impossible for their rivals to compete with them. For example, by buying up mineral lands, oil fields, etc., colonial possessions alone gives complete agreement of success to the monopolies against all the risks of the struggle with competitors, including the risks that the latter will defend themselves by means of a law establishing a state monopoly. The more capitalism develops, the more the need for raw materials arise, the more bitter competition becomes, and the more feverishly the hunt for raw materials proceeds all over the world, and the more desperate becomes the struggle for the acquisition of colonies. Schleider writes, quote, "It may even be asserted, although it may sound paradoxical to some, that in the more or less discernible future, the growth of the urban industrial population is more likely to be hindered by the shortage of raw materials for industry than by a shortage of food," end quote. For example, there is a growing shortage of timber, the price of which is steadily rising, of leather and raw materials for the textile industry. Quote, as instances of efforts of industrial associations to effect a balance between agriculture and industry in the world industry, we might mention the International Federation of Cotton Spinners Associations and the most important industrial countries founded in 1904, and the European Federation of Flax Spinners Associations founded on the above pattern in 1910. End quote. The bourgeois reformists, and among them particularly the present-day adherents of Kautsky, of course, try to belittle the importance of facts of this kind by arguing that it would be possible to obtain raw materials in the open market without a costly and dangerous colonial policy, and that it would be possible to greatly increase the supply of raw materials simply by improving agriculture. But these arguments are simply an apology for imperialism, an attempt to embellish it, because they ignore the principal feature of modern capitalism, monopoly. Free markets are becoming more and more a thing of the past. Monopolist syndicates and trusts are restricting them more and more every day, and simply improving agriculture reduces itself to improving the conditions of the masses, of raising wages and reducing profits. Where, except in the imagination of the sentimental reformists, are there any trusts capable of interesting themselves in the condition of the masses instead of the conquering of the colonies? Financial capital is not only interested in the already known source of raw materials, it is also interested in the possible sources of raw materials, because present-day technical development is extremely rapid, and because land, which is useless today, may be made fertile tomorrow if new methods are applied. To provide these new methods, a big bank can equip a whole expedition of engineers, agricultural experts, etc., and the large amounts of capital are invested. Side note, like a quick little real-life example of this, silicon. Silicon wasn't really fucking useful for anything, but people bought up the land that silicon was on, and then boom, silicon is useful in computer chips, and then the people who owned the land that you could mine silicon on got fucking rich. I think. Anyways, this also applies to prospecting for materials, to new methods of working up and utilizing raw materials, etc., etc. Hence, the inevitable striving of finance capital to extend its economic territory and even its territory in general, in the same way that these trusts capitalize their property by estimating it at 2 or 3 times its value, taking into account its possible future, not present. Returns, and the future further results of monopoly. So finance capital strives to seize the largest possible amount of land of all kinds, and at any place it can, and by any means, counting on the possibilities of finding raw materials there and fearing to be left behind in the insensate struggle for the last available scraps of unappropriated territory, or for the repartition of that which has already been appropriated. The British capitalists are exerting every effort to develop the cotton grown in their own Egyptian colony. In 1904, out of 2.3 million hectares of land under cultivation, 600,000 or more than one-fourth were devoted to cotton growing. The Russians are doing the same in their colony, Turkestan, and they are doing so because in this way they will be in a better position to defeat their foreign competitors, to monopolize the source of raw materials, and form a more economical and profitable textile trust in which all the processes of production will be combined and concentrated into the hands of a single owner. The necessity of exporting capital also serves to stimulate the quest for colonies, for it is easier in the colonial market, and sometimes it is the only possible way, by monopolists, methods to eliminate competition, to make sure of orders, to strengthen the necessity of connections, etc. The non-economic superstructure, which grows up on the basis of financial capital, is based on its politics and its ideology, stimulates the striving for colonial conquest. Quote, finance capital does not want liberty, it wants domination, as Hilferding very truly says. And a French bourgeois writer, developing and supplementing, as it were, the ideals of Cecil Rhodes, which we quoted above, writes that the social causes should be added to the economic causes of modern colonial policy. Quote, owing to the growing complexity and difficulties of life, which weigh not only on the masses of the workers, but also on the middle classes, impatience, irritation, and hatred are accumulating in all the countries of the old civilization and are becoming a menace to public order. Employment must be found for the energy which is being hurled out of the definite class channel. It must be given an outlet abroad in order to avert an explosion at home." End quote. Since we are speaking of colonial policy in the period of capitalist imperialism, it must be observed that finance capital and its corresponding foreign policy, which reduces itself to the struggle of the great powers for the economic and political divisions of the world, give rise to a number of transitional forms of national dependence. The division of the world into two principal groups of colony-owning countries on the one hand and colonies on the other. It is not only a typical feature of this period, there's also a variety of forms of dependence, countries which formerly are politically independent, but which are, in fact, enmeshed in the net of financial and diplomatic dependence. We have already referred to one form of dependence, the semi-colony. Another example is provided by Argentina. South America, and especially Argentina, writes Sulzhij Gavranich in his work on British imperialism, is so dependent financially on London that it ought to be described as almost a British commercial colony. Basing himself on the report of the Austro-Hungarian consul at Buenos Aires, Schilder estimates the amount of British capital invested in Argentina in 1909 at 8.750 trillion francs. It is not difficult to imagine the solid bonds that are thus created between British finance capital and its faithful friend, diplomacy, and the Argentine bourgeoisie, the leading businessmen and politicians of that country. A somewhat different form of financial and diplomatic dependence accompanied by political independence is presented by Portugal. Portugal is in fact a sovereign nation. In actual fact, however, for more than 200 years, since the War of Spanish Succession in 1700 to 1714, it has been a British protectorate. The British had protected Portugal and her colonies in order to fortify her own position in the fight against their rivals, Spain and France. In return, they received commercial advantages, preferential imports of goods, and above all, the capital into Portugal and the Portuguese colonies, the right to use ports in the islands of Portugal, her telegraph cables, etc. Relations of this kind have always existed between big and small states, but during the period of capitalist imperialism, they become a general system. They form part of the process of dividing the world. They become a link in the chain of operations of finance capital. In order to complete our examination of the question of the division of the world, we must make the following observation. This question was raised quite openly and definitely, not only in American literature after the Spanish-American War, and in English literature after the Boer War, at the very end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th, not only has German literature, which always jealously watches British imperialism, systematically given its appraisal of this fact, but it has also been raised in French bourgeois literature in terms as wide and as clear as they are possible from the bourgeois point of view. We will quote Dayrault the historian, who, in his book Political and Social Problems at the End of the 19th Century, in the chapter The Great Powers and the Division of the World, wrote the following. Quote, "During the recent years, all the free territory of the earth, with the exception of China, has been occupied by the powers of Europe and North America. Several conflicts and displacements of influence have already occurred over this matter, which foreshadow more terrible outbreaks in the near future. For it is necessary to make haste. The nations which have not yet made provisions for themselves run the risk of never receiving their share and never participating in the tremendous exploitation of the globe, which will be one of the essential features of the next century, i.e. the 20th. This is why all Europe and America has lately been affected with the fever of colonial expansion, of imperialism, that most characteristic feature at the end of the 19th century." End quote. And the author added, quote, "In this partition of the world, in this furious pursuit of the treasures of the big markets of the globe, the relative power of the empires founded in this 19th century is totally out of proportion to the place occupied in Europe by the nations which founded them. The dominant powers in Europe Those which decide the destinies of the continent are not equally preponderant in the whole world. As colonial power, the hope of controlling hitherto unknown wealth will obviously react to influence the relative strength of the European powers. The colonial question, imperialism if you will, which has already transformed the political conditions in Europe, will modify them more and more. End of that quote, and end of this chapter of imperialism. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Book Club Colony. Next episode, we'll be reading Chapter 7, Imperialism as a Special Stage of Capitalism, which, should be good. It's going to be a longer one, hopefully. This episode was a bit short, but I'm out of practice of reading, and 25 minutes ended up really hurting my throat, and I can't really do anymore. I can't do another 25 minutes of another chapter, so that's all you're getting for now. Hopefully, as I'm in summer, I should be able to have more time to record, although equally, it might end up being I have even less time. It really depends on how shit goes. So it's going to be play it by ear. Hopefully, I have more time to record and we can just get this book done, and then we'll move on to State and Revolution, hopefully sooner rather than later. Hopefully, geez. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Book Club Colony. Please be sure to like and share and send this to your comrades. Anyone you think needs access to this text or just needs to engage with it in any way. When this book is all said and done, this is a really great book to give to people because it really gets into like the economic basis for imperialism and why it's important to fight it. It is a little outdated in its references, which... if I haven't mentioned it before, after I finish reading this whole book, go and listen to Marx and Madness as they read Kwame Nkrumah's Neocolonialism, the highest stage of imperialism, is that the highest stage or the last stage of imperialism? That is a really good work, and it pairs with this text amazingly, and it's basically like an update of this book. So after you get done with imperialism, or you read it on your own, go either read Nkrumah or listen to Marx Madness, read Nkrumah. It was really good. I thoroughly recommend it. Almost forgot to do an outro, to do my legit outro. And as always, solidarity forever, and keep on reading.